Welcome to A Podcast for Everyone, practical conversations answering your questions about how to make websites and mobile apps work for everyone. This podcast series is brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn, Rosenfeld Media, The Pass Yellow Group, and O'Reilly. Today, Whitney Quisenberry will be talking to Dean Caraviti about designing personal health records.
Hi, I'm Whitney Quisenberry, and I'm co-author with Sarah Horton of A Web for Everyone. Today I'm talking to Dean Caraviti from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where he's a human interaction specialist in clinical informatics. Well, that sounds like a mouthful, but it really just means that he works on making medical information usable for both patients and health professionals. One of his current projects is designing personal health records that are useful for people with disabilities. Hi, Dean. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, Whitney. Thank you so much for inviting me to talk about our work.
So let's start by talking about what you mean by a personal health record for people with disabilities. What kind of problems are you trying to solve?
Well, first, I think we could start with some definitions. They're actually important for a number of reasons. If you were to go to the healthit.gov website, there's a page that provides precise definitions for different systems used in health information technology. And what's interesting about these definitions is they're largely based on system interoperability. What that means is the ability for these systems, or the lack of ability for these systems, to share information between different healthcare providers or organizations, as well as to patients.
Okay, so this is all technical. This is, can one computer talk to another?
Yes, in effect. If I could go through some definitions, and then I can explain to you why it's important to people with disabilities. So first we have the electronic medical record, or the EMR. And this is defined as the electronic version of the patient chart, but exists only within a single healthcare organization, for example, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, or another hospital in town, or even your doctor's office around the corner. Corresponding to that on the patient side is what's often referred to as the patient portal. This allows patients or family members to log in, access some of the record, and perform some basic tasks like prescription renewals, lab results, things like that. But again, like the EMR, they are confined or limited to a single healthcare organization. So you might be receiving care from different providers, and each might have their own EMR, and therefore you might have multiple patient portal accounts, none of which are connected.
That doesn't sound very good.
No, it's a big problem, and there are many people working on this. Well, next we have another definition, the EHR, or electronic health record. And this refers to, again, a clinician system. But unlike the EMR, this has information about the patient from any and every provider they've ever seen.
So now we're getting a little more patient-centered.
Yes, but the problem with the EHR is it, at least in the United States and at a practical level, it really doesn't exist yet.
Okay.
Then we have the PHR, or personal health record. And this is defined as a system that is managed by patients where they can collect, compile, organize all of their information from multiple healthcare providers in one place. But the problem there is it's not easily connected to healthcare providers.
Okay, so we have a mythical EHR, the thing that's going to pull all of our data together. And then we have, kind of to make up for it, something patients can use on their own systems.
Right.
So we have a mythical EHR that will pull everything together, but doesn't quite yet. And then we have kind of, is it sort of filling a gap to say we have a personal health record, which the patient can manage to solve that gap?
Yes, it allows them to manage their own information, but it doesn't allow them to easily share that information with new or existing healthcare providers.
So another gap appears.
Yes. But in our project, we decided to use the term PHR somewhat generically and imagine hopefully a near future state where interoperability is solved.
Okay. So this sounds like a pretty big generic problem. And I'm sure you're right that there are probably thousands of people in the U.S. working on it, if not more, around the world. Tell me where this connects to accessibility.
Okay. Well, as part of our project, exploring accessible personal health records, one of the methods we applied was performing a survey with 150 people with different disabilities. And in that survey, we had our participants rate over 20 health topics in two ways. First, in terms of how important the particular topic was to their health and healthcare, and second, their current level of satisfaction with a particular issue or topic. And the number one most highly rated issue in terms of importance was the ability to share medical information between different providers, offices, and hospitals.
Okay, so this isn't just a technical, you're not just looking at a chart and saying, here's a gap, let's fill it. This is actually coming from people. So are you talking about people with various kinds of disabilities here?
It certainly applies to people with severe disabilities, but also anyone who is a complex patient and receives care from multiple healthcare providers. Because the real underlying issue here isn't just the transfer of data, but care coordination, which is the collaboration and not just communication, but collaboration between multiple healthcare providers.
When we were talking before, you said something that I thought was really important, and I want to make sure we bring it out early, which is that disability doesn't necessarily mean poor health.
Right. And the source of that idea and that concept, which I think is really a very valuable resource that your listeners might be interested in, is the Surgeon General's Call to Action to Improve the Health and Wellness of Persons with Disabilities. It's freely available online. I'm sure you'll be providing a link to that on your website.
We sure will.
Well, in the report, which was published in 2005, it doesn't really cover healthcare technology, but it does a wonderful job, I think, of describing the overall landscape, you could say, of people with disabilities and health and healthcare. And so the authors make a number of important points. First and foremost is that people with disabilities can live a meaningful and fulfilling life, but the key is health and wellness. However, they go on to present a number of studies and data demonstrating that people with disabilities encounter myriad disparities with almost every aspect of health and the healthcare system.
So give me some examples of things that might challenge them in managing their health.
The report cites a number of measures, for example, higher risks, poorer outcomes, access, really almost everything you can think of. And what's, I think, important about that is now we know people with disabilities are underserved by technology that's not accessible, but they're also underserved by the healthcare system.
So tell me about some of the kinds of health issues in specific someone with a disability might need to manage.
Okay, well, this is a pretty large topic, and there's different ways to think about this. So as you stated before, that we should not equate disability with poor health and not think of disability as an illness. And one thing that Surgeon General's report stresses is that we should treat not the disability, but the whole person. And this was reflected with many of the participants in our study. So, for example, we met plenty of people who were disabled, but their disability wasn't necessarily a health issue, meaning it didn't require ongoing care or any type of treatment, nor did these people think of their disability as a health issue. At the next level, there are people who have a disability, and while their disability isn't necessarily an ongoing health issue, there are secondary issues related to their disability that need to be managed. And I have a few examples. For example, a person who's blind and might have to take some eye drops to sort of maintain their tear ducts. Or it could be a person who's deaf and has a baby and undergoes genetic testing to determine whether or not their baby has a particular variant for hearing loss. Then there might be a person who has a spinal cord injury and is using a wheelchair. And with that comes a number of secondary issues. For example, first we need to prevent pressure sores or bed sores, and there's special cushions that can do that, as well as checking and maintaining skin integrity. They also might have a urinary catheter. Along with that, we have to prevent infection and also measure daily fluid intake and output. And then at the next level, we met plenty of people where their disability was the result of an illness that required ongoing treatment, for example, multiple sclerosis or spina bifida. And then there is yet other people who had these types of issues along with other more common chronic illnesses, for example, diabetes, heart disease, high cholesterol, etc. And what we found is that we learned a lot from, of course, all of our participants, but from these more complex patients, they often provided us with the most detailed, sophisticated, and even innovative ideas on what an accessible PHR should do.
You know, it's interesting, Sean Henry, who wrote the book Just Ask, about doing usability testing with people with disabilities, has been talking about questioning whether we ought to be thinking about people with disabilities as extreme users, that is, people who might be particularly stressed by websites that aren't written to code, or by information that isn't very clear, or by information that doesn't appeal to all their senses, so that if they're relying on one sense more than other senses, they're more likely to find the problem. And that's a pretty interesting idea. And I think what you're saying is very much the same, that people with disabilities use the healthcare system a lot and in many different ways, both as people with many different chronic health problems to people for whom their health isn't really an issue at all, to people who need some sort of monitoring of things like what you said about monitoring infections and fluid intake and outtake. So that suggests that you have a population that represents, in a very small group of people, a wide range of what a good personal health record needs to do.
Oh, absolutely. I actually had a chance to talk to Sean on the telephone about a month ago about our project, and she was fantastic. And I agree with this. And I think there are many people who promote this idea of the extreme user. I have two sources where I've learned about this method or this concept, you might say. First, I met a gentleman from IDEO a number of years ago, and he told me that this was a foundation of their approach to design in many ways. Maybe not specifically to people with disabilities, but any extreme user who sort of represents the tail end of the normal curve. They're more interesting and we can learn more from them. Another great example of this method in practice was the industrial designer Mark Harrison. He was both a teacher and designer at the Rhode Island School of Design. And way back in the mid-70s, he applied this approach specifically by thinking about people with disabilities in the design of the Cuisinart food processor.
Oh, way before the Good Grips, huh?
Yes. Some people say that Harrison's work and teaching actually influenced people who went on to design all these wonderful kitchen devices. He actually influenced technology, too. I have an interesting little story here that I love to tell. If you read the Steve Jobs biography by Walter Isaacson, there are two references to the Cuisinart, where Steve Jobs told the original designers of the first Mac to go out and buy Cuisinart. It's great. You have to see this thing. And if you put the original Mac in 1984 side by side with an early 80s Cuisinart, the influence on the physical design of the Mac is immediately obvious. Not only was the Mac designed with software for accessibility and more universal design, but its physical design had this perhaps unknown influence as well.
So this goes along with the idea I'm hearing a lot in design circles, which is that the broader your influences, you know, get out of your little box and look for inspiration all over the place. In fact, IDEO's Open IDEO project really espouses that because they start with inspirations as their first step, where people are encouraged to go out and get as broad and crazy as many ideas as they can and bring them into the group. So can you give me a story about how one of your extreme users helped you see something interesting that you wrapped into the project? I think we've been talking a little theoretically, and I'd love to bring it down and ground it in some of your research.
Sure. Well, I have many interesting stories, but there's one in particular I'd like to share with you. One of our participants was a woman who a number of years ago was in a horrible accident. She was a pedestrian hit by a drunk driver, and this left her paralyzed from the neck down, paraplegic. Not only did she survive her injury, but she insisted on staying at home, though confined to a bed or wheelchair with home health aides, in order to raise, I think, her three or four children to adulthood. Well, once her children were full grown and out of the house, she had more time to pursue her own interests. So one thing she did, for example, she's always interested in art. So she learned to paint both realistic portraits and landscapes by essentially holding a paintbrush in her teeth. That's pretty amazing, I think. She also had never used a computer, but wanted to learn. So with help from one of our project partners, the Inglis Foundation here in Philadelphia, and their assistive technology experts, she learned to use a computer, but the only way she could interact with a computer was using speech recognition, Dragon systems. So she had to learn both a PC and navigating a PC and all the different applications while simultaneously learning how to use Dragon systems. Well, she told me a story that brought together both healthcare and technology. A little while back, she had seen her physician, who I believe specialized in people with spinal cord injuries, and they did some lab work, and there was some particular level, I'm sorry, I don't remember what the level was, that was low. And the doctor prescribed her some supplements to bring this level up. Well, I believe she went home, and she thought about this, and she wasn't happy about this prescription for at least two reasons. First, like a lot of people with disabilities, she has a very fixed, limited income, and this represented an additional cost that she really couldn't afford. Second, she just didn't like the idea of taking a pill. So she went online and did some research and identified a number of foods that could help increase this blood level. So on her own, she changed her diet and then created a spreadsheet where she tracked not only her diet, but these different blood levels over time. When she finally reached the desired level, she went to her doctor and said, okay, we've met the level. Here's what I did and here's my data. Well, the doctor was so impressed that she not only agreed with this treatment course, she now prescribes the same dietary changes to other patients who have the same issue.
Well, I think what I love about that story is not the kind of personal overcoming of difficulties, but that how she used essentially a very small PHR. I mean, she created her own little PHR to manage this, so she was able to, you know, use data to solve her own health issues, but also to suggest things that could be used for other people.
Sure. And what this really demonstrates, what I think was really interesting about it, is it demonstrates some of the work we're doing at Children's Hospital and research on shared decision-making using patient portals or different systems to support decision-making and collaboration between patients and providers. One of our researchers, this is his focus, his name is Dr. Alex Fix. And what I've learned from Alex is that decision-making is really founded on first defining and communicating a person's preferences and goals. Then you come up with a plan to meet those goals, and then you develop some measure that can be used to track the progress in meeting that goal over time. So this woman's story perfectly represents a shared decision-making model, and everything's there except for a PHR that could support the collection and communication of this information.
So we've been talking about this project for a long time, and we haven't given you a chance to talk about who's involved and how you brought together the team, because I understand it's three organizations, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, the Inglis Foundation, and NCAM and WGBH. Why don't you just tell me a little bit about who's involved and how the collaboration comes together?
Okay, well, the project is led by WGBH and the National Center for Accessible Media. They received the grant from the Department of Education National Institute on Disability Rehabilitation and Research, NIDER. Both Inglis and myself and my boss, Dr. Grenmeyer, are collaborators on the project with WGBH. The grant is referred to as a field-initiated project. So unlike a more traditional research project, its real goal is to demonstrate some process towards improving the life or every aspect of people with severe disabilities.
So it's like what we would call a pilot.
Exactly. Now, we couldn't build an actual PHR, but the project was designed to demonstrate the application of both usability and accessibility methods, including with subjects of people with disabilities, in essentially going through a whole series of usability methods towards the final product of interactive prototypes that we user tested.
So at the end of this, NIDER, which is a federal agency, will end up with not just a bunch of concepts, but some good user-centered design supporting the results and hopefully take it further. Is that the goal?
Right. And all of our methods, results, and even the prototypes are freely available to EMR, EHR vendors, developers, anyone in the community.
That's really great. I know that you have a website. I think it's healthitaccess.wgbh.org.
Yes, WGBH is managing that, yes.
And we will, of course, as always, have links and all the other names and links that we've been mentioning on the website. I know that a couple of your collaborators asked if they could be on this podcast, but we kind of think it's an easier conversation when we can't see each other to do it one-on-one, but I'd like to just give them a nod and hope that you have represented them well.
I hope so.
So what else have you learned? Is there been anything that's surprising, or actually my favorite sort of ideas are ideas that seem obvious once you've seen them happen in the research? Anything that's come out that really jumped out for you?
Yes. You know, beyond all the data and the results and the analysis, there's something that I actually learned a long time ago but continued to relearn, and I think it's very important, and you referred to this many times. In technology, UX, many people are striving to create accessible technology, and then other people are striving to create innovative technology. And unfortunately, there are still people, though not in the UX community, who feel that accessibility can be a barrier or somehow inhibit innovation, when I believe the exact opposite is the case. People with disabilities can be the source of many innovative ideas. Going back to the mid-90s when I started working with people with disabilities in assistive technology, I remember a few things. First, I was forced to learn about and apply very rigorous usability methods. There was really no way around that. So it's a great environment for that. At the same time, I was extremely selfish and thinking repeatedly, boy, this stuff is so cool. I wish I had this on my computer. For example, touch screens, on-screen keyboards with word prediction, zoomable displays, speech recognition, text-to-speech. Think about it. It took about 10 to 15 years, and now we all have it on our computers, our phones, and other devices, and we absolutely love it.
Mm-hmm. That's a really, really great example. I think sometimes it just takes a while to figure out. We sort of start with a new technology, and for a while, there's the technology looking for a problem. And often, extreme cases are the problem they solve, and then it slowly migrates into general technology.
Sure. And I had the same thoughts in this project by taking all these different participants and their experiences and their stories and their ideas and creating these PHR prototypes. I found myself thinking repeatedly, boy, this is a pretty cool PHR. I wish I had one, not only for myself, but my family, friends, and of course, all the physicians and patients we work with.
I want to touch on one thing that relates to methods. If people are interested in what you did, there are great write-ups of all of your surveys and your prototyping and your usability testing. And I don't want to take time to go through them here because they're much more comprehensive on the web than we could cover. But one of the things that a lot of people find as a challenge is finding people with disabilities who they can work with and setting up a usability test to be able to include people in their research. Can you talk a little bit about how that worked for you?
Sure. Well, we had a distinct advantage in that our project partner, English Foundation, manages the care of hundreds of people with disabilities. So not only were they a collaborator in the project, they were a source of many of our participants. However, they specialize mainly in people with severe physical disabilities. So we also found another organization here in Philadelphia, Liberty Resources, who helps people with all types of disabilities live independently. So they provided us with other participants too, and they were a great help. There is certainly a lot of people out there with disabilities, and they all seem very appreciative and enjoyed being part of the project. I think another resource might be your local university. Most have some type of assistive technology lab and or faculty and students who are interested in accessibility. That might be a good resource too.
So it sounds like one of the pieces of advice I heard was to not wait until you are ready to do your first usability test to get to know people. It's like, don't just put out a call and announce that you're ready for the doors to open, but actually do a little bit of outreach in advance. Start making those connections early. Find out who's in your community, what organizations are there, what schools are there, so that you're building those relationships before you ask people for their help.
Absolutely.
So I just want to end with kind of one other thing, which I was reading the website, and it says one of the things you did was an audit of 3 personal health record websites. And of those 3, one only met half of the basic accessibility guidelines, and that sounds really terrible, but the other 2 only met 2 out of the 12 guidelines. But then it goes on to talk about a kind of inverse relationship between accessible and functional. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, it was really an interesting experiment. We reviewed these 3 different systems for both usability, accessibility, and also functionality. And I really felt like I was sort of in the Goldilocks scenario, though, of course, there wasn't one that was just right. So, example, the first system, they seemed to have made an honest effort at meeting accessibility guidelines, yet the system functionality was really very limited, and usability was also a problem. There was some very complex navigation, very confusing. The other system that did the worst in terms of accessibility actually had the most functionality, and a lot of very sophisticated functionality matching some of the ideas from our participants. The third system was somewhere in between. It was a PHR type system. It was pretty good in accessibility except for one particular issue. It relied on patient-entered data, and with every piece of patient-entered data, you had to enter a date. Well, their date widget was neither accessible for screen readers or keyboard only. So I thought it was interesting representing just one little problem that could be such a huge barrier. But overall, I think what we learned from that exercise is that if you were to put these 3 systems together, you'd have a pretty great PHR. And I think what's fundamental here and interesting is that technology isn't the problem. There's no constraints. There's no issue with making an accessible PHR. It can be done. And I think the real issue here with these systems really comes down to good requirements gathering and then the application of a solid set of both usability and accessibility methods.
So was the focus of your work really about understanding what a PHR needed to do because you already knew how to make things accessible and usable?
Well, yeah, we actually talked about that quite a bit. WGBH, people like yourself, many are promoting all types of accessibility methods, and there's plenty of that out there. We didn't feel like we could add too much to the excellent work that's already available. So instead, we wanted to go in a different tact and think about or demonstrate, in effect, what if we designed a PHR specifically for people with disabilities? What would that be like? Would it be usable? Would it be accessible? Would it be functional? And I think we answered that. I hope we answered that. That not only would it be accessible and usable, but also highly functional and more innovative than existing systems, precisely because it's based on people who face a lot of challenges, both with their health, but also access, mobility, finance, everything. And as a result, have many more interesting and detailed ideas on how we can better engage with the healthcare system.
I think that's an awesome place to wrap up, actually. Dean, this has been fascinating. I think we could talk for hours, but I'll just say again that there's lots more information and some great research stories up on the Health IT Access site. Tell me a little bit about some of the people who really helped make this project sing.
Okay. Well, at WGH, we had a number of people. Larry Goldberg, who is the PI of the project, who's the director of NCAM, Madeline Rothberg, who's a project manager, Jeff Fried, who is their accessibility expert, at Inglis Foundation, their CEO, Gavin Kerr, who's fantastic, Leah Frontino, who's their VP of Health IT and Innovation, Don Waller, who's the head of their assistive technology lab, and did a lot of work in not only connecting us with participants, but building test stations that we could use for the participants we tested at Inglis. And CHOP, myself and my boss, Dr. Grundmeier, who is one of our most amazing researchers, physicians, developers, analysts, statisticians.
Cool. That's a really big team. That's kind of cool. I'm used to hearing more about projects that are a couple of people sort of in a skunkworks project, but this sounds much more well-rounded.
Yes. Oh, and I forgot one person. I'm sorry. Jason Withrow, who's a developer. He's a contractor, and he also has a degree in HCI and experience with accessibility.
We'll give a shout out on the website, and I'll get some papers from you that might be interesting for people who want to dig a little more deeply in the research. So just to wrap up, if you're interested in learning more, the project website is, again, healthitaccess.wgbh.org. To find the podcast page on rosenfeldmedia.com, look for the page for A Web for Everyone, that's our book, and follow that link to A Podcast for Everyone. Thanks so much to you for listening in, and a special thanks to our sponsors, UIE, Rosenfeld Media, the Paciello Group, and O'Reilly for making this series happen. Be sure to follow us at A Web for Everyone on Twitter for information about future podcasts.
Thanks for joining us for A Podcast for Everyone. This series is a companion to the book A Web for Everyone, co-authored by Sarah Horton and Whitney Quisenberry. Be sure to tell us what you want to learn next at awebforeveryone@gmail.com. This podcast series is brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn. UIE's All You Can Learn will give you the skills and techniques you need for a competitive design advantage with 24/7 access to UX experts and topics. Rosenfeld Media. Rosenfeld Media offers unequaled UX expertise in print and in person. Their experts consult, teach, and write books like A Web for Everyone. The Paciello Group. The Paciello Group helps organizations make their technology accessible to everyone, including people with disabilities. As always, thanks for listening.